Our first case this morning is Smith Kline Beacom versus Apotex. Mr. Faribault.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. There are a couple of errors of law we'd like to ask the court to correct. One is on claim construction. One is on remedy. As far as claim construction is concerned, there are only four words in the claim. It's clear, unambiguous. If you look at the certification letter from Apotex that started this case, which is on page 8832 of the appendix, Apotex didn't have any difficulty understanding what the claim meant. They did not say in that letter that the claim was indefinite.
Mr. Faribault, isn't this case a prescription for a perpetual patent? You can come up with an ever purer crystalline form and then recognize that it'll degenerate into trace elements of an infringing form. And so after this patent, we'll have an even purer crystalline form and an even purer crystalline form with practically the same, well, it does have identical, the same utility, and yet it'll always degenerate into trace elements of the prior one. Perpetual patent, very much against our vision of the patent system with limited terms.
Well, I would think that would be, Your Honor, but that's not this case.
How can it not be this case? It's precisely this case. You've got Paxil being used for Paxil, and what they've done is got a different crystalline form that degenerates into the former. And you're saying, well, we've got infringement.
Your Honor, Paxil came on the market in 1993. It's only been on the market 10 years. The patent issued in 1988. The patent will expire in 2006. After that, anyone can make crystalline peroxide and hydrochloride hemihydrate. The problem that Apotex has is they chose to make a form that they knew was unstable. If you look at Dr. Sherman's letter, which I think is a smoking gun in this case, he acknowledges at A8300,
and you tried very hard to convince me that it's Apotex's fault, but doesn't the record show and the district judge find that this seeding process presents an inevitable case of infringement? There's almost no way to avoid it.
There are two ways to avoid it. One is to avoid seeds. The other is to avoid water, and Apotex didn't try to do either one. In fact, they purposely brought the seeds into their facility by grinding up Paxil tablets. And they also used a humid environment with up to 60% humidity and used a water-based coating for their product.
But under the law, though, Mr. Faribault, don't they have the right to test the Apotex in order to file the ANDA application?
Yes, they do have a right to test, but, Your Honor, they don't have a right to commercialize when they know they're going to infringe. The key fact
but,
in
but
this
you're
case...
Saying that, you're saying that they brought it into the lab themselves. They brought the Apotex into the lab, right?
No,
Apotex,
Your Honor,
brought it in.
They brought Paxil in.
They brought Paxil in.
And they also made hemihydrate. So they tested hemihydrate to see what its properties were.
So hemihydrate, though, is that a stable product?
It is a stable product.
But the hemihydrate is not a stable product.
The anhydrate is the one that's unstable, Your Honor. And the anhydrate was known to convert to hemihydrate. SB published that in 1987 in the Buxton and Lynch article. Dr. Sherman read that. He knew it. He read the patent. The patent itself says that the product, the anhydrate form, is unstable. If you look at A8300, that's Dr. Sherman's letter, he says precisely that. He says and admits that people in the art knew in 1996, quote, that peroxide hydrochloride anhydrite converts to peroxide hydrochloride hemihydrate when exposed to moisture and compressed into tablets. He said that four times in that document over the course of three or four pages at A8300. Why did he say it? Because his own head of technology at BCI, Dr. Murthy, wrote him a letter, which is Appendix 8829, which says there are several polymorphs of this product. Some of them are unstable. And the one they chose to make, he said, they were found to be unstable under humid conditions. They knew it converted, and yet they went ahead anyway. Now, why did they do that? Yeah, they wanted to be first generic in the market. I understand that. They wanted to make a lot of
money. What does it take to convert it, though?
Sir?
What does it take to convert it?
It takes water and seeds of the more stable form.
So the seeding, how was the seeding done? The seeding was done.
Seeding is what their expert, Dr. Threlfall, admitted to be adventitious seeding. That means the seeds are present in the atmosphere. Dr. Threlfall was asked about that at Appendix 5130, and Judge Posner on page 5581, when Mr. Parr over here came back and was questioning the witness about whether there would be adventitious seeding and whether it would cause conversion, the judge said, your expert already admitted that. Why are you asking this question?
But is that a natural conversion? It's automatic, isn't it?
What
does it take to convert it?
It has rate controls, Your Honor. It has the hemihydrate has water, one molecule of water inside the crystal form. If there's water present, then that crystal form will tend to form, provided there are templates or seeds on which that crystal form can form. There are other more stable forms. Judge Rader, if you look at A8829, Apotex at that point had another form that was, they said, is much more stable, but they chose not to make that. They chose to infringe because they didn't think they were going to get caught.
More stable than anhydrite or more stable than the hemihydrate?
More stable than either one of them, this memo says, Judge Bryce.
Okay. Can I ask you, I infer from your brief that your claim construction is one crystal is all that's required to satisfy the claim. Is that claim one?
Right? Any amount.
Any amount. So any, one crystal or more.
It says it's a chemical compound. If that chemical compound is present, then I think that's an infringement. There are three things, of course. There's claim construction, there's proving infringement, and then there's what's the remedy going to be.
And now, if let's suppose, and I think Judge Posner gets pretty close to this. He may not quite cross this bridge, but let's just suppose that the circumstance was that there is enough now, by virtue of the invention of hemihydrate form, there is enough of the hemihydrate in the biosphere that there is no way that anybody could, under any circumstance, make anhydrite that would not have some hemihydrate conversion. Your view is that would necessarily result in infringement, regardless of the amount.
Well, I don't think that's true.
I understand, but Judge Posner comes pretty close to saying that. I think you'll agree with me, but
It gets to Antarctica.
Right. But let's just suppose that, take my case, in which we don't even have to argue about that, just scientifically incontrovertible. There would be, I take it in your view, infringement under those circumstances.
I think there would be infringement if there is hemihydrate present.
Now what if, to take that one step further, how do you analyze the following case? Suppose that SmithKline, in order to try to prohibit anybody from making the anhydrite form, goes over to the lab where it's being made and basically seeds the area sufficiently that it will cause conversion. What's the right way to analyze that case? Because then you'll have conversion.
Well, I think if you had water. Now, they could make an Alka-Seltzer plant and avoid water.
Well,
there's
water vapor. I mean, I take it all you need is water vapor. There's water vapor in the atmosphere, even in Antarctica. It's low, but it's there.
Sure. Well,
okay, but
there are precautions you can take. Well, they didn't take them. But anyway, I think the point is that there are many, many other salts that they could make.
Well, okay,
there are other crystals.
But before you get to the other salts and so forth, how do you analyze the case in which someone has done something in order to provoke the conversion and then tries to get a remedy against the asserted infringement?
Sure. Your Honor, if I think there would be a case where there would be no equitable relief because conversion was caused.
How about damages?
And damages, I think, in Imbrex, in Judge Rader's opinion in Imbrex, he talks about damages being the remedy that that you'd look to in a case of de minimis infringement.
Well, so, but you'd have infringement. The infringement, so are you saying that you would not have damages under the circumstances that I set out because...
If you went in and intentionally caused the infringement,
right,
then there might not even be liability.
Right, but what would be the theory?
I can't
of
think.
That's my problem too. You see, I'm struggling to try to come up with.
Judge Posner certainly was trying to do that.
He was, and that's the the central question in this case is, what's the place we start with at that end of the spectrum and work backwards to this case?
I notice I'm on my rebuttal time, but Your Honor, we
go ahead.
Okay. The key here is whether or not SB caused the infringement. We didn't cause them to infringe. They intentionally made an unstable form. Anhydrate, it's not like, they want to say anhydrate was in the 196 patent. Anhydrate is never mentioned in the 196 patent.
Well, Judge Posner says Smith-Kline is the cause of the infringement. You disagree with that characterization, but that's...
Well,
his view of the matter.
That was his conclusion of law because he concluded that they had a license based on their Hatch-Waxman safe harbor, and therefore because of that license it was us that caused the infringement. I don't think that's good reasoning. He says elsewhere in the opinion that they themselves went out and brought the Paxil into their plant and that they made hemihydrate in their plant. Now, that whatever safe harbor you have under Hatch-Waxman can't carry forward to commercial production, and it's not intended to do that.
Mr. Furball, let me just ask you a hypothetical. Let's assume that I'm a corn farmer, and I have a field of corn, and that corn basically is growing 6 feet tall, and it's yellow corn. My neighbor uses your seed, which is a blue corn seed, and he gets beautiful blue corn. But the next year, because he has raised blue corn in a field next to mine, my corn also turns blue. And it has the same DNA as your blue corn. I did nothing to buy your seed or otherwise, not buy any seed from him. It was seeded by his blue corn coming over in my field. Am I infringing your patent at that point?
Patent infringement is a strict liability tort, as I understand. I think the answer is yes. I think the claim still reads blue corn, and you still are making or producing or selling blue corn, so you're infringing. I think the real question is, what remedy is the patentee going to get?
But if your seed naturally came into my field and seeded my field naturally, I did nothing to seed it myself.
I think you're still infringing.
Let me ask you one other quick question. And we'll make sure that everybody gets plenty of time and the equal amount of time.
Thank you, Ron.
If I understood your colloquy with Judge Bryson, you're interpreting this claim to mean any amount, and it's not limited by its ability, of course, to display its useful qualities. It's not limited to the uses of Paxil.
That's Zenith. That's a Zenith case.
Yeah, that's true. Therefore, the pharmaceutical uses and efficacy of the compound are not the claimed features, right? That's not what you're claiming.
It is the utility of what's claimed.
Yeah, that's the utility, but it's not what you're claiming.
It's
not the claimed feature.
Depends on the context, Your Honor.
It's not the claimed feature.
It is in one of the other claims. It's not in claim.
It's not the claim feature of this.
It's
so
not listed in claim one.
So yes, why, sir, don't you have a public use?
Because
there's, you're not, you weren't testing the claimed features in the way that you've construed the patent.
No, as I understand the law, Your Honor, every compound has a utility. You have to have a utility in order to file.
Oh, yes,
and you're
certainly
entitled to experiment with regard to the utility. And that's what we did.
I think we say claimed features are what you are testing for.
Well, but that claim includes every use, and particularly the ones that are listed in the patent. If you look at EZ-Doc, EZ-Doc has a lot of discussion in it about whether the feature needs to be in the claim in order for it to be part of the invention which can be tested to avoid a public use through experimental use. And you've got Manville, the light case where they tested in the winter. You've got SealFlex, the athletic track case. And in none of those was the particular element that was being tested or utility that was being tested part of the claim.
Ms. Farber, could there ever become a point in time when a synthetic molecule becomes a natural molecule, just totally existing in nature, even though it was synthetically derived?
I think it's possible, Your Honor. I don't know. I think of penicillin, which I guess is a natural molecule, but we think of it as something that's made synthetically most of the time. So that's about as close as I can come, I think.
So what happens in a situation where the synthetic molecule just permeates the entire atmosphere and it can't be eliminated?
Then I think you've got a very good patent, Your Honor. But that's not the case here. The case here, I think they can find places and conditions to make anhydrite. And they didn't choose to do that. They could have done this testing at a different lab. They didn't have to test Paxil at their plant. Yeah, they want to say they were entitled to, but they knew what was going to happen. Look at 8300. That man knew. He was designing their process.
Well, you're arguing willful infringement, and your point is that there doesn't have to be willfulness at all. There's no intent in infringement.
That's right.
You've made that point very clearly, so I'm not sure why you need to rest yourself on their fault in this instance.
Well, my point is that
it's
Judge Posner
so
seemed to be troubled a lot by it.
I'm sorry. It's because it's so tough when there's inevitable infringement, you really do get into that perpetual patent problem, don't you?
Well, I don't think there's inevitable infringement, Your Honor, and certainly there's no perpetual patenting in the hemihydrate is a very stable form. In 2006, when this patent expires, they'll be entitled to make hemihydrate and they'll have no problem making it.
And of course, my hypothetical is that what happens when there's a tetrahydrate and a quadrahydrate and an ever pure crystalline form that degenerates into the former infringing uses, you've got a perpetual patent. Just string out the pure crystalline forms. Don't have any new utilities, no new uses.
Your Honor, that's not what happened here. Here,
okay. I understand your point on that. Right. Why don't we move on to?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Let's move on and hear Apotex, Ms. Mizochi.
Mizaki,
thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Judge Posner reached the right result here. Judge Posner construed the claims, and he recognized that claims should not be construed in a vacuum, but rather that claims are always constrained by the disclosure that's in the specification, in the prosecution history, the understanding.
This is such a clear case of policy-driven claim construction. The very thing we always counsel trial judges to avoid. Looks at the outcome, doesn't like the outcome, and quickly starts trying to see how he can jimmy the claim construction to come up with something that that doesn't infringe. Anywhere does it say only in commercially significant amounts?
Oh, I think if you turn to the specification, and that's in column one, the named inventors pointed to the reasons why the hemihydrate was patentable over the prior art as having certain analytical features derived from the structure, as being stable, non-hygroscopic, having good handling qualities. And there was unrebutted testimony at trial that the nature of a substance that would be able to achieve.
Do we limit structural claims to their uses, to their functions?
Oh, I don't believe.
No, that's even beyond importing limitations from the specification. Do we limit them to their specific uses?
No, I don't think that you are importing improper limitations into the claim at all.
This is a structure claim. No one perceives ambiguity in it. They all know exactly what it is. And four words, but everybody knows what the four words mean.
Well, I believe that SmithKline has different.
And so where do you come up with commercial significance tacked on to the end of those four words. And I don't see commercial anywhere in the specification.
Oh,
I see significance in the specification. I see references to substantial here and there and things like that that weasel words put into every patent.
Your Honor, I believe if you look at column one of the specification.
All right. You've got it right in front of me.
Approximately line 49. It starts, however, for commercial use, it is also important that the solid product have good handling qualities. Then they go on to differentiate their product from the prior art, which is described as being amorphous paroxetine hydrochloride, which is a hygroscopic solid of poor handling qualities. They now say, continuing on, it has been discovered that paroxetine hydrochloride can be produced in crystalline form in a manner reproducible on a commercial scale. And they then go on to say, here's what allows you to be able to make this material on the commercial scale. You have a material that has certain analytical characteristics. It is stable, non-hygroscopic, and has good handling qualities. And as Judge Posner noted in his opinion, the reason why these features, such as non-hygroscopicity, come about is in fact tied to the very nature of the hemihydrate molecule itself. I believe Judge Posner referred to the molecule as not being thirsty anymore, that because it has the water arranged in its crystalline structure, it no longer acts in a hygroscopic manner, which is in contrast to the amorphous material as well as the crystalline anhydrate material that was also in the prior art and made by Farisan. So as a consequence of that, Judge Posner heard testimony that was not disputed by SmithKline that the only way in which you were going to be able to achieve a substance which was, for example, non-hygroscopic, is if you had hemihydrate that was present in levels at the high double digits. And it was that concept of the high double digits that Judge Posner deemed to be commercially relevant when he construed the claims. So as a consequence of that, we believe that Judge Posner's claim construction is supported by the specification. It's also supported by the British priority documents that SmithKline used as the basis for filing the 723 patent. They're British priority documents, which are found in the prosecution history, in which this court has said in the Glaxo v. Ranbaxy case, may be used for claim construction purposes. In the British priority documents, SmithKline identified four possible substances, one which was hemihydrate, one which was anhydrate, one which was a mixture where hemihydrate was the predominant component, and one where anhydrate was the predominant component. And they provided analytical tests that differentiated between the anhydrate and hemihydrate. And they also said that what differentiated the hemihydrate from the anhydrate was its stability, non-hygroscopicity, and good handling qualities. Now, when SmithKline proceeded to the United States with their U.S. patent application, they abandoned the description of the anhydrate. They abandoned the description of the anhydrate as a major component. And they don't even say specifically in their U.S. application that they contemplate their invention to be hemihydrate with the anhydrate as a component. They only proceeded with claims to the hemihydrate. So against that background, Judge Posner also had a basis for believing and for construing the claim to require hemihydrate in the high double digits. Furthermore, Judge Posner also had the testimony of Mr. Curzons, the inventor, who differentiated the material that he claimed to have invented based on its stability, non-hygroscopicity, and good handling qualities. So in view of all of that testimony and all of the intrinsic evidence, Judge Posner was fully justified in arriving at the conclusion that one is not within the scope of what's claimed by Claim 1, absent the presence of hemihydrate in the high double digits.
If you don't prevail on that claim construction argument, do we have to construe Chaldamine May?
No, Your Honor, you do not. And the reason why is because we have since received final FDA approval, and we are now on the market. As a result, the only remedies that would be available to SmithKline are those found in 35 U.S.C. Section 271 E4 B and C. And even SmithKline, in its opening brief, conceded that the remedies that are provided for in those two sections are, in fact, discretionary for the district court, because they do use the word shall. I'm sorry, they use the word may. I'll read it for you.
Well, we're fine.
Okay. And
Ms. Mazzocchi, just one question. Regarding the conversion of anhydrite to hemihydrite, is that done naturally? Does that happen by itself in a lab, or do you have to do something to convert it over? What has to be done?
Well, we don't believe that our product does, in fact, convert to hemihydrate. There was evidence presented at the trial court level that indicates that, in fact, the hemihydrate may be converting to the anhydrite. But with respect to SmithKline's position before the trial court, they did take the position that one does not really have to do anything to the anhydrite material in order for it to convert. It is effectively a passive conversion. And I think that that troubled Judge Posner considerably, because it raises two problems. The first question is, can passive conversion to infringing material ever be considered to be an act of making or using an infringing substance? The second problem that presents is exactly what you pointed out, Judge Rader, is that you are now creating a situation where a patentee can argue that their species to a hemihydrate can dominate the entire genus of paroxetine. Paroxetine in all of its salts was disclosed in Farisan's 196 patent. That patent expired in 1992. So realistically, paroxetine and all of its pharmaceutically acceptable salts are part of the public domain. SmithKline now comes along with this hemihydrate, and under its single crystal theory, is arguing that it is now effectively entitled to stop any pharmaceutical company from making any paroxetine material, because you will never be able to prove that there's no seeds there. There will always be an exposure to water. So under their theory, you will always have some single crystal of infringing material in there, and you don't even have to actively put it there. It might waft in on the air.
Because of the natural conversion?
Because in SmithKline's view of the world, you have to do nothing to bring about conversion aside from expose your product to seeds, and that can come just by nature of its exposure to the air.
Setting aside what each of the two parties views is the right way, and you of course take very different views as to what you think the evidence showed. How do you read Judge Posner's finding on that issue? Because a lot of his opinion is somewhat discursive, and it's a little unclear to me exactly how far he goes in the direction of saying that this is a natural, i.e. inevitable process.
Yes, I can understand your confusion, because on the one hand, he seems to imply that this is like the law of gravity.
Yes.
Yet, in a different location in his opinion, he recognizes that the mechanisms of polymorphism are not well known, are not well understood, and SmithKline's own expert, Dr. Bernstein, testified at trial that each polymorphic system is different.
What is your take on where he comes down? I mean, we are dealing with a tried case, with findings of fact and conclusions of law, so that's the platform from which we are starting.
Right.
And so we have to understand, regardless of the fact that the parties may take different views, what exactly it is that the district court viewed as the right way to look at this scientific process.
Right. I believe that Judge Posner found the seeding theory to be intellectually fascinating. And I think that he was faced with some testimony from SmithKline's experts as to the concept of seeding. The problem is that he took that and then assumed, for purposes of finding infringement under the single crystal theory, he assumed that he could take the theory and an inference with no underlying actual proof that hemihydrate would in fact be present, and that can only work under the assumption that the hemihydrate is everywhere and that conversion will inevitably occur.
Isn't that one of his findings of fact? If you go through the entire 71 pages, one of the findings of facts that he does come out with is a conversion of amihydrate to hemihydrate is by natural process, essentially. It can be done without any further action.
He does identify that as being possible. I think he did place some restrictions in terms of the amount of water and timing and temperature and that sort of thing.
But very limited.
That's correct. But the types of situations, Mr. Faribault mentioned the Buxton and Lynch paper. That paper, which serves as the crux of all of Smith-Kline's theories as to why anhydrate would convert to hemihydrate, in that paper, the scientists were using extreme temperatures, extreme pressures on the order of 10 tons or more, and those are certainly not found in our tabulating process, and I believe Judge Posner did recognize that fact. If I may, I'd like to address a few points on the 102B issue. With respect to the...
You have 5 minutes beyond the red light.
Okay, thank you. With respect to the 102B issue, it is undisputed that by the critical date, the inventors had isolated and identified the hemihydrate. They concluded that it offered patent opportunities. They'd made hemihydrate capsules, sent them to doctors, given them to patients. The inventors had no involvement.
But what do you test for if not for the uses, the utility of a pharmaceutical?
Well, they were testing to the extent you want to call
it. Testing its efficacy.
Well, the efficacy limitation appears nowhere in Claim 1, which is the only claim that's at issue here on appeal. Second of all, Smith-Kline had the information already found in the 196 patent that the paroxetine molecule itself was an antidepressant. The crystalline hemihydrate, once it gets into the stomach, is going to dissolve to form a paroxetine molecule. It's paroxetine that gets absorbed by the bloodstream. It's not, you don't have an actual crystalline particle making its way to the 5-HT receptor sites in your brain tissue. So the fact that, and I believe even in the 723 specification, Smith-Kline concedes that the 196 patent taught that paroxetine was an antidepressant. So in view of that, the notion that Smith-Kline was conducting FDA clinical trials to figure out whether paroxetine, whether it's in an amorphous liquid anhydrate or hemihydrate form, could be useful as an antidepressant is rather nonsensical. The reason why people get FDA approval is so that they can commercially market a product. And it would be similar to, in terms of understanding efficacy, Mr. Faribault mentioned penicillin. If you have penicillin and you know that it operates by killing bacteria, and because it kills bacteria, it's a useful antibiotic. If you come up with a molecule that's got a structurally similar nucleus, like Cipro, you throw it into a test tube with some bacteria, and you see that it kills them off, you can reasonably expect that this might serve as a useful antibiotic in humans. Now, maybe when you get to FDA clinical trials, you're going to want to test for safety and efficacy. You'll want to make sure that there's no unforeseen side effects. You're going to want to ensure that maybe it's not going to cause problems if it's consumed by pregnant women. But you will have a reasonable expectation that the material will, in fact, work as an antibiotic. The fact that you've even set up clinical trials, and here we had multi-center clinical trials taking place not only in the United States, but worldwide, the idea that you would be engaging in these clinical trials if you had no reasonable expectation that paroxetine could work as an antidepressant, that's simply not the type of experimental use that this court's precedent contemplates. What we have here, and I understand that Judge Koukouras was concerned about safety and efficacy testing, but under this court's precedent, particularly in In re Brana, this court has never stated that a patentee needs to have engaged in phase 3 clinical trials before it can file a patent. And as we noted in our reply brief, we believe that if that's the precedent that this court intends to establish, that would actually run contrary to the Patent Term Restoration Act provisions that are provided for in the Hatch-Waxman amendments, because currently under Hatch-Waxman, an NDA applicant with a new drug is only entitled to get a patent term extension that goes no later than 14 years after the date on which you receive final FDA approval. If concepts of safety and efficacy are going to be mandated by any claim to a pharmaceutical product, pharmaceutical companies will be able to constantly say, well, we were just experimenting, and they will be able to avoid the possibility of a public use bar and potentially extend their patent term out to beyond 14 years, possibly even as long as 20 years.
Here, of course, I suppose that if in this case there had been the inventors had run this test with extraordinary confidentiality requirements and secrecy and so forth, and absolutely no information about the test going out to the public and so forth, the same, your same example would would be entitled to do that, I guess, even under your analysis, right?
It depends.
But, I mean, they just wouldn't be publicly using it, right? There wouldn't be a public use problem.
I think that there would be less of a public use problem if the inventors here had been in control of these clinical tests. But
public use is an on-off switch. I mean, if there's, I guess what I'm trying to ask you is this. Your argument about policy, the patent extension provision, the patent term extension is, it seems to me, not necessarily, doesn't necessarily answer the problem, since it would seem to me that one can avoid public use and simply not go to patent until one's good and ready, right? What would be the...
Well, you have the limitation of if the invention is already reduced to practice, then that would end any claim to experimental use.
So, all right, and you think in the public use as opposed to the on sale setting, the reduction to practice, the acquisition of the crystal itself starts the clock running.
That's correct.
What's your best case for that proposition?
I believe there are, that with respect to the idea that reduction of practice ends experimental use,
right,
Allen Engineering, with respect to the question of are the inventors actually experimenting, Lau v. Brunswick stands for the proposition that if you are not experimenting with a claimed feature of the invention, you are not experimenting. And here,
of course, we've had cases like the SealFlex case, which was durability in bad weather was not one of the claimed features, but that was regarded as being within the scope of legitimate experimentation, if I recall correctly.
But with the SealFlex case, they actually had to conduct experimentation sort of out of doors. You know, here, there's no element of the claim that suggests that safety and efficacy to FDA standards is what's being contemplated here, and particularly not in view of the single crystal claim construction, where all they're saying is that to prove infringement, we just have to find the existence of a molecule that's got this structure in it. If the standard for infringement is going to be, we just have to prove the presence of this molecule, then the standard for validity should also be, all that matters is, did you identify and isolate the structure of this molecule? And I believe
Do you have some concluding thoughts for us?
Yes, Your Honor. We believe that Judge Posner did correctly construe the claims, and similarly that SmithKline here was not engaged in any experimental use with respect to the hemihydrate in the United States, causing the patent to be held invalid.
Can I just ask one other question? I guess procedurally, the posture we're in with respect to the cross appeal is that there was a summary judgment granted against you and denial of your motion for summary judgment of invalidity on the 102B, correct?
And a granting of SmithKline's
right,
motion for summary judgment.
That's my understanding. And that if we were to reverse here, the ordinary course would simply be to send it back for further proceedings on that issue and overturning the summary judgment that was granted. I take it that you would like us to do a double jump, so to speak,
yes,
not only to overturn the summary judgment, But to leap forward and say that there's no issue of fact here which could possibly be triable with respect to the invalidity public use 102B.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Misaki. And Mr. Faribault, are you going to send some Paxil to the panel to help it treat the depression caused by this case?
Would Your Honor like branded or generic?
That's the subject of the case. You may proceed. You have 6 minutes, by the way.
Thank you. As a technical issue, these polymorphs don't just convert all the time. Dr. Bernstein, who is the world's noted expert on this, wrote a paper called Disappearing Polymorphs, which is in the appendix. And over his career, he cites maybe 15 examples of this happening. That's why Mr. Curzons was so excited when he discovered this new polymorphic form. He knew it was unusual. He knew it was something that could be very significant and important. And that's what it's turned out to be. That's the form that SmithKline has marketed. And you can't go back then to the anhydrite. Yeah, if they wanted to make Paroxetine, they could make Paroxetine maleate. That's disclosed in the 196 patent. That patent's expired, and they could make it. And they could file a 505B2 instead of a 505J, and they could try to sell that different salt. But then it wouldn't be substitutable in the marketplace. The pharmacist couldn't just substitute theirs for ours. That's why they wanted to use ours. And that's why they're willing to take a chance on an unstable polymorph in order to do it. So I don't think this permanent conversion from one form to another is really something that the court needs to be troubled about.
Mr. Faribault, with respect to the findings of fact made by Judge Posner, is it your opinion that there was a finding of fact that conversion from anhydrite to hemihydrate was a natural occurrence just by taking without any further action?
No, sir, I don't believe
there
it was.
There was no finding of fact to that effect?
I think that what he found was that it converts in the presence of seeds and water. And if you have an environment that has both of those things and you add pressure and temperature, the more you have, the more you're going to get. And he said, for example, that in 1985, if you practiced the 196 patent, you would not inherently get hemihydrate because there were many areas that did not have those factors that you needed in order to produce it.
Mr. Faribault, do you agree with Ms. Misaki's point that we don't have to reach the Chalmay issue, that if we get to that point of the analysis, we're really not under the Hatch-Waxman Act? We've got broader discretion for equitable remedies?
No, I don't, Your Honor, because the statute itself sets forth three remedies, A being that the date of approval will be postponed until the date of expiration of the patent. Then may grant an injunction, may award damages, but the first one says shall. And that still applies, even though Apotex is now on the market. They went on the market after Judge Posner's decision. That's why I gave you the generic option. But the statute itself is clear that you're entitled to all three remedies. And the legislative history, which is cited at page 51 of our original brief, footnote 12, says, if the infringing party has begun commercial marketing of the drug, damages and other monetary relief and injunctive relief may be awarded for the infringement and to prevent further infringement. In addition, the FDA would be mandated to change the effective date of the approved ANDA to the expiration date of the infringed patent. So I think we're entitled to that 271E4A remedy in any event. And I think shall does mean shall. I think this court said that in Apotex v. Thompson regarding the ANDA statute. The Supreme Court certainly said it in the Alabama case, which I think is very analogous here. I'd like to move on briefly to the public use issue. And I think there, Apotex confuses utility with reduction to practice. Judge Kokouras clearly found there was no reduction to practice. If you look at the, and the issue was mainly regarding rat brain tests. And if you look, anhydrite had been used on rat brains. And if you look at cone one test, this is at appendix 13-224. Cone ran the first double-blind test in the U.S. on anhydrite. And it didn't work. And Dr. Simon, our expert on this area, said it didn't work. And Cone himself said it didn't work. Simon's opinion is at A1296 and 97. So how can you have something reduced to practice that doesn't work? And it was only through subsequent testing of efficacy that it was established over long years. The final data was filed in 1989, 5 years later. The product wasn't approved until 1992. It didn't go commercial until 1993. And we're arguing about something that happened in 1985, within 5 months after they discovered the product. It's not true that the inventors were totally absent either. You look at A11938 and at Seek, you find that the inventors were back working. They were working on flow problems. They were working on improving the process. They don't have to be involved in clinical trials. That's not their expertise. This court has held repeatedly that the assignee is entitled to control that kind of efficacy testing. So I think Scott B. Finney is our best case. More complex an invention.
Mr. Fairbowl, could you answer Judge Bryson's question?
Yeah, I have just one question. Straighten me out, or perhaps you and Ms. Mizaki can together straighten me out on the relationship between the public use and reduction to practice. Well, assuming we have something that we would be prepared to call a reduction to practice at some point before the critical date, is that it for you?
Well, I don't think it is, and our brief suggests that it's contrary to FAF to say that it is, because FAF has two prongs, one being ready for patenting, which would include reduction to practice, and the other being, is it experimental or is it commercial? Now, this court has said two or three times in recent cases, like Zacharin, for example, which I think was dicta, but also in a couple of other cases, that reduction of practice ends experimental use. That goes back to the old RCA case.
Right. And reduction to practice. Well, assuming we have something that we would be prepared to call a reduction to practice at some point before the critical date, is that it for you?
Well, I don't think it is, and our brief suggests that it's contrary to FAF to say that it is, because FAF has two prongs, one being ready for patenting, which would include reduction to practice, and the other being, is it experimental or is it commercial? Now, this court has said two or three times in recent cases, like Zacharin, for example, which I think was dicta, but also in a couple of other cases, that reduction of practice ends experimental use. That goes back to the old RCA case.
Right.
But I don't think it is under FAB.
And is there a different rule, you think, with respect to on sale from public use? With respect to that question?
On sale, and there may be. On sale makes it a lot easier because, for example, in the Abbott case, you didn't have to look for whether it was suitable for its intended purpose because it had been sold. So
right.
You could assume that it was useful for its intended purpose. So I think on sale raises more a lot more strenuous issues than public use, because public use, then you really have to look at it. Were you doing test marketing? Every case where this court has found public use, I think there's been a real issue of test marketing. And that's not what was going on here. It's clear. We were saying experimental use only. We were saying this is an investigational drug. It was 8 long years before
okay.
we were able to sell this product.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fairbowl. Thank you, Ms. Mizaki. Our next case is Dynacor Holdings versus U.S. Phillips.
Wait a second.
One second.
She has a cross.
I do think she does.
I don't think she has any time left.
I think we have a cross appeal, which the court was a little depressed. Ms. Mizaki. You have 3 minutes.
Thank you, Judge Rader. I'll be brief. First, with respect to the public use issue, Mr. Faribault mentioned the Abbott case, and he said that there, because it was being sold, it must have had a purpose. If peroxine hydrochloride, hemihydrate, was being used in worldwide clinical trials for the treatment of depression, it was known to have a purpose. What really happened here is SmithKline applied the wrong clock in terms of when they should be applying for a patent. They introduced this material into the United States, into the public domain, in May of 1985. That should have been what started the clock running in terms of the date on which they filed a patent. They didn't use that date. They used the date that was the clock that was tied to their British priority application's filing date. SmithKline never introduced any test data from the clinical trials into their U.S. patent application. If the point of the experimental use doctrine is that patentees are supposed to figure out whether it's valuable to file a patent, and the public is perceived to attain a benefit by that because they get a more perfected invention, here, Mr. Faribault just said that they didn't even think they had the perfected invention until after the patent issued. The only data that SmithKline relied on for safety and efficacy of the hemihydrate was data that had already been disclosed, the rat brain data, in the Farisan 196 patent. The public obtained no additional knowledge about the nature of the efficacy of paroxetine as a consequence of SmithKline's quote-unquote experimental use. Similarly, Mr. Faribault also talked about how companies should be allowed to go on and conduct clinical trials on behalf of inventors. The problem with that is that SmithKline's position that they didn't know that the hemihydrate would work for its intended purpose means that nobody had conceived of the idea that the hemihydrate might in fact work as an antidepressant. Now, if none of these named inventors had any involvement with the clinical trials, somebody must have conceived of the idea of hemihydrate being useful as an antidepressant, and that person is certainly not named on the face of the 723 patent, which would imply that either the inventorship is wrong or that the knowledge is with respect to paroxetine's use as an antidepressant was sufficiently generally known and disclosed by the 196 patent such that you didn't need to further provide any conception.
Well, a lot of experimentation, even setting aside the FDA efficacy and safety and efficacy requirements, a lot of experimentation is done for the purpose of confirming what is suspected. And it would seem to me a natural process in a corporate setting for somebody other than the people in the particular component that are doing the inventing to run the test. And it doesn't seem to me necessarily to be the case that those people would be contributing anything other than their expertise in conducting a test which is designed to try to establish whether that which was suspected is in fact present. But does it make a lot of sense to say, well, you've got to bring the inventors over to the other side of the building where they stand around while the tests are conducted in order to avoid the defeat of the experimental use exception?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that, or it's Apotex's position, that if it turns out that you have some type of surprising efficacy results that come along in these later experimentations, if you want to call them that, that would have been unexpected compared to the teachings that were already known for paroxetine in the prior art, then maybe you would be justified in filing a continuation in part application or something along those lines.
But in my concern is with what I would take to be the great bulk of the cases, which is that the inventors suspect that something's going to work in the following way. They send it over to the testing guys, and they say, run this, maybe it's a tire or something. They run this tire around the track a few times and see if it works. And they're not over there. Maybe they will be out of interest, but they're not necessarily going to be over there running the tire around the track to see if it works. They think it'll probably work, but they don't know for sure. The tests are run.
Are you suggesting that they lack involvement, sufficient involvement in this experimentation, therefore experimental use doesn't come into play there?
Yes, because you would think that the person who sends the tire off to the road track to be tested is going to have the guys doing the testing report something back to him. Here, the inventors didn't even get any clinical trials reported back to them.
Thank you, Ms. Mazzocchi. Thank you, Mr. Faribault.